Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's such a distinctive sound, rich and quick and round. It's the sound of the vibes, the vibraphone. The sound made famous by jazz great Gary Burton. He picked up the mallets as a boy in Indiana, mastered the vibes, went to the top. But life stories are complicated. Gary Burton, no exception. Today, he's a vibes master, then longtime music educator who barely listens to music. He's got a family story to tell, a sexuality story to tell, and a big music story. This hour, On Point jazz great Gary Burton's big, big fusion story in jazz. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Where do the vibes take you? What do you think of where they've taken Gary Burton? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is jazz great vibraphonist Gary Burton, 7-time Grammy Award winner, composer, educator, pioneer of the jazz vibraphone. His first recording came out when he was just 17. He's recorded over 60 albums since 1961, bridge, jazz, rock, country. He's also former dean and executive VP at Berklee College of Music, where he taught for more than 30 years. And he was one of the first major figures in jazz to come out as openly gay. He's out with a new album with the new Gary Burton Quartet called Guided Tour and with a big autobiography called Learning to Listen, the jazz journey of Gary Burton. Gary Burton, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
Wonderful to have you. Hey, can you just describe what's going on? This is the lookout behind us. It's off latest album. Who's playing what? What's going on here, Gary? You're the music educator. Educate us.
That's me on the vibraphone. I'm soloing at this very moment.
Yeah.
And the other frontline instrument in the quartet is the guitar. That's Julian Lodge, a super talent young man, 25 years old, and already, you know, a well-established player on the jazz scene. And then our rhythm section, we have bass and drums. The drummer is Antonio Sanchez. And the bass player is Scott Colley, and that's our band.
And is all this off a score? Are you improvising as little as you go, or how's it working here, Gary?
Well, this is a composition written by Julian. All the members of the group contribute material for the group to play. And this one is just a sketch. We have what's called a lead sheet. It's 16 measures, 16 bars long, and it's a theme over a fairly basic set of harmonies. And so the basic song itself, the written part, lasts maybe 20 seconds. And then we start improvising using the same set of harmonies of the tune. And I soloed first. Now the guitar is soloing. I can hear in the background.
The guitar really sends up the signal that we've got some kind of blues work going on here.
Yes, this is definitely a kind of blues. The standard blues is 12 measures long. Mm-hmm. This one is 16, so it's stretched out a little bit. But otherwise, it has all the elements of blues, a lot of dominant 7 chords being featured, and blues notes, as we call them, that to the listener's ear, they'll say, oh, that sounds bluesy.
Bluesy, but yet it's jazz. And the thing that makes it jazz is the way you break it apart and mix it up, or what? How would you describe that?
Yeah, well, the central feature of jazz has always been the improvised soloing that goes on. Improvising is a lot like contemporaneous speech, about just having a conversation or explaining something to someone. You start with a basic concept, which is the song, and then you start making up your own melody off the top of your head as you're playing. Just the same way when we talk, we don't think about nouns and verbs and so on and sentence structure. We just think of the point we want to make, and the words kind of, you know, spontaneously come into our consciousness and we speak them. Same thing happens with an experienced improviser. We have the song and we want to make musical sentences, and our brain does the same thing it does with language. It has a big vocabulary of stored musical information and also a sense of the grammar of music, how mm-hmm. things are put together. And it forms these musical phrases that are sentence-like. And as they come into our consciousness, we become aware of them, we play them. So it really feels like you're speaking a language.
Let's push that a little further then. That's the jazz improvised soloing, and we understand that as a signature dynamic of jazz. But bluesmen surely improvise when they solo as well. So what's the difference?
Yes, that's true. And so do, in fact, country musicians.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Country instrumentals, violin players and banjo
mandolin,
players and
let
so
it
on.
Go, yeah.
Yeah, do a fair amount of improvising as well. In the case of jazz, it's generally more sophisticated, more complex, and more extended than mm-hmm. what you will find in other genres of music that do have improvisation. It's really the specialty of the jazz musicians.
The wonder of you, Gary, is that you've been doing this for so long, first playing, then teaching, and then we can hear it already just in that wonderful elucidation. I mean, you can take this up very high. So let me go high with you. You spent your life in jazz and fusion. It's improvised soloing. So compare jazz and life. Is jazz freer? I mean, life is improvised soloing, I should think.
Absolutely. We do have generally, starting points and something in mind when we start to play, the same as when we start to speak. Mm-hmm. We have something we want to explain or talk about and that sort of thing. We just don't know the exact words we're going to use,
right,
or maybe exactly where our story is going to take
Boy,
us.
Boy, do I know that. That's every day.
Until we get into the story.
Yeah.
But it's a lot about storytelling. I sometimes compare what we do to the stand-up comedian mm-hmm. who has a general, story that he's going to tell, but he tells it differently each night, different mm-hmm. pacing depending on how the audience is reacting, occasionally veering off the subject when a new idea pops into his mind. That's what happens to us when we're playing. We never play the same solo twice. Elements, yes, will pop up and reoccur, but it's a new telling of the story every time we play.
I'm still trying to put that up against that big old capital L life itself. Is it part of the appeal for you in jazz that you have such freedom when you're doing that improvised soloing there? Does life feel, life itself, with all its complexities and extended quality, does it feel constrained, trapped next to your moments in the midst of music?
Yes, life is, much more imperfect than what you can achieve in the music. And I think that's one of the big attractions to being a jazz musician, is that it feels free because, it's happening spontaneously, and you can reach quite a high level of getting what you want to take place in the music. Life, unfortunately, throws up all kinds of hurdles and obstacles and diversions that make it more of a challenge. So that's why I think we musicians turn to the music for inspiration and for those feel-good moments that we look forward to each day.
Well, you talk about the starting point for jazz improvisation. How would you describe your starting point in life, the kind of opening sentence or the opening inclination that set you off? What was your starting point for that long, extended solo?
Well, it was influenced very much by my evolving music. I started playing when I was 6 years old, and at that point, it's the music experience is very intuitive. You learn differently at age six than you do at age 25, and In fact, that's the golden age to start music, mm-hmm. is when you're 6, 7, 8 years old. And almost every musician you ever talk to will tell you that's when they started playing the piano or whatever. It's quite rare for someone to become a proficient musician. Getting a late start doesn't happen very easily. But I'm sure that my life has been shaped by the fact that I started performing by age 8. And so I had gigs to get to.
You were a big prize winner. They were putting you on the radio. You were the talent show whiz kid.
And I felt a responsibility. The show must go on. And people were sitting there listening to me and applauding what I'm doing. And I felt a responsibility to get it right and to impress them and communicate with them. So I often describe my childhood and my growing up years as, almost being non-existent. I was the world's youngest adult because I was surrounded by adults that I played with, and so I was always pushing myself to be a grown up.
A little sound of that right behind us here from 1961, Gary Burton's debut album, New Vibe Man in Town. His new autobiography with all kinds of extended, sophisticated improvisation is Learning to Listen, the Jazz Journey of Gary Burton. You can join us. Do you like a little vibraphone in your jazz music? Do you like it front and center? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Gary Burton. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with jazz vibraphone great Gary Burton about teaching and playing with the giants of jazz, about a unique instrument and a very full life. His new autobiography is Learning to Listen, the Jazz Journey of Gary Burton. It tells his story all the way from a young boy in Indianapolis, or Indiana, I should say, not Indianapolis, but Indiana, all the way deep into the world of jazz, about his own sexuality over those years, sometimes suppressed and finally open, about the many jazz greats that he has played with. Behind us right here from a dual Stan Getz Joao Gilberto concert at Carnegie Hall in 1964, Stan's Blues, Stan Getz on tenor, and very young Gary Burton right there on vibes. He joins us today from New York, and you can join this conversation as well. Do you like a little vibraphone in your jazz? Do you like to know the stories of where these guys come from, this guy, this jazz man, and did a music moment somewhere set you off on a long road, a long improvisation that became your life? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. How's it happen, Gary? I mean, I know you were great at 8 years old. How do you get from there and sort of North Indiana, then South Indiana to Carnegie Hall?
Well, it was an unusual path that presented itself to me. I detoured to Nashville, Tennessee.
Right. Hank Garland.
To the country capital. And the last thing I would have expected, I mean, I had my focus set on moving to the East Coast as soon as I finished high school to go to Berkeley in Boston and get connected to the jazz community that I was convinced I would find there. Mm-hmm. But I got an invitation to spend the summer in Nashville working with a local guitarist who was really one of the main studio musicians in the country scene, but also was a terrific jazz player. And his name is Hank Garland.
Yeah.
And The offer was come to Nashville for the summer and we'll play weekends at this local club and we'll make a record. And that sounded fantastic to me. I was 17 years old, and this was the first big opportunity I'd had to do something in jazz. And not only did we do that, but I also ended the summer with getting my own record contract from RCA. They noticed me playing there locally in Nashville, and even though the Nashville office of RCA, which was run by guitarist Chet Atkins at the time, you know, they wouldn't normally be dealing in jazz musicians, became convinced that I had a future and offered me a contract. So when I headed east to Berkeley, I already had a record contract in my pocket, and the rest just kept on happening.
Pretty great combination of things there. Your own education at Berklee School of Music, where you later spent a lot of time as an educator yourself. And vibes themselves in this arena? I mean, I know Lionel Hampton had been out there, but how were they seen? Did you have to sort of fight the vibes onto the stage, or were people hungry for vibes to be included in jazz in those days?
Well, I'll tell you, it's an interesting set of contradictions. On the one hand, I'm convinced that one of the reasons I got such an early start in my career and recording at 17 and on the road with George Shearing at 19 and with Stan Getz at 20 and 21 was because I didn't have a lot of competition as a vibraphone player. There were other players, but it wasn't like there were hundreds of players on the instrument. I think if I'd been a pianist or something, it would have taken a longer time of apprenticeship before I would have reached the big time, as we say. On the other hand, the vibraphone is not an instrument that people think of when they're forming a band. So I learned early on that if I wanted to get into bands, that I had to take the lead. And I was always the guy that had the van and had, you know, found a place to rehearse and wrote songs for the band to play and got the jobs and so on. So I got to be included that way.
But I have the sense that there were some kind of vibes, maybe renaissance is the wrong word, but birth into jazz going on. I remember as a very, very young kid, suddenly vibraphones seemed popular and people started to have them around and I mean, xylophones, too. There was this whole mallet craze, if I'm not mistaken. But who brought it into jazz? When did jazz suddenly turn and say, well, you know, we want more of that?
Well, Lionel Hampton was the pioneer. The instrument was invented in 1929, 1930. And during the 30s, he was in the most famous jazz band of the decade, which was Benny Goodman's group. So he got a lot of visibility for the instrument. And even by the time I started playing the instrument in 1949, it was only 20 years old. So it was still, you know, struggling to get recognized by people. And to this day, when people find out I'm a musician, I say, "Oh, what do you play?" I take a breath and I say the vibraphone and wait to see their reaction. And 90% of the time, 90% of the time they say, "Well, what is that exactly?" And I have to describe it's like a xylophone and you play it with sticks and so on. In fact, Milt Jackson, one of the famous vibraphone players who was certainly the leading player when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, I noticed one day when I saw him that he had a little pin on his coat of a little vibraphone. And I thought, hey, look at that. That's really cute. Where'd you get that? And he looked at me very seriously and said, "I got that. So when people say, what's a vibraphone, I can just point to it."
Simple as that. Gary Burton is with us. Wonderful new memoir is out, Learning to Listen. And Gary, there are a lot of people who want to talk with you. Stillwater, Oklahoma. Beth is calling. Beth, you're on the air with Gary Burton.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Gary. It's a huge pleasure to talk to you. I'm a big fan. I'm a percussion student, and I've been studying and playing percussion for a long time. And as I'm sure you're well aware, there's a pretty popular grip named after you, the Burton grip, the four mallet. And I was just wondering what it's like to be a household name in percussion education now.
And describe, Beth, if you would, what that grip is for our listeners who don't play the vibes.
Well, there's usually, you can play vibes with two mallets or four mallets, and just two mallets in each hand. And it's a special way of holding the mallet so that you can, you know, utilize each mallet individually and be able to play with four.
So two in each hand, and that is the Burton grip. That makes you, Gary, the household name. What about it?
Well, I didn't choose the name, the Burton grip. That's just kind of came about years ago. And it turns out that, in fact, my approach to holding the mallets has become quite popular. And just from an informal survey that I constantly kind of do when I meet players, it's about half the people who play with four mallets use my grip. You know, there are a couple of other ways of holding the mallets that some people prefer instead, but mine has become quite popular.
When you use the Burton grip, may I ask, Gary, as a novice here, you've got two mallets in that hand. So can you manipulate the distance between them, or are you always having to hit, what do you call them, keys or bars, whatever it is?
Bars or keys.
So but do no, they always yeah, have to the, be the you, same distance apart?
No. You adjust, mm-hmm. and you can open and close the sticks. It's a little bit like chopsticks in reverse. In fact, I'm great with chopsticks.
Okay, that's a pretty wild conceptual idea. I'll have to have a couple and think about chopsticks in reverse. But okay, yeah, now I can kind of see it, the way they're spread there. And that has got to have fours just opens the sound and the complexity up gigantically then.
But it allows you to think like a piano, like a mm-hmm. keyboard instrument. So the two concepts for a vibraphone, you can either treat it as a single line melody instrument, which is the two mallet approach, where you only play a single line like a horn would play, like a trumpet or a saxophone. Or you can play it like a piano, which means you can play chords and counterpoint and multiple lines. And so with four mallets, you have more options in terms of what role the vibraphone can play in a band. You can play solo unaccompanied and have the music sound complete. I mean, that's why I became a four mallet player to begin with. I lived in a small farm town, and I was the only musician in town.
Yeah.
I played alone a lot,
yeah.
and I wanted to get some harmony. I wanted it to fill in and sound complete. So at the time, the standard wisdom was that playing with four mallets was impractical, so don't waste your time mm-hmm. trying to practice it. But I didn't have anyone telling me I couldn't. I was on my own in those years. So I just kept messing around with it and playing more and more with four, and discovered that once you get, as we say, the hang of it,
yeah.
It's not so complex after all. And now probably half to two-thirds of all mallet players play with four mallets these days.
How old were you when you really went to four, Gary?
Eight.
Wow.
8 years old, 9 years old.
I'm trying to picture that moment, that kind of Gary Burton Superman moment in the little farm town, playing with the mallets all alone and the big vibraphone and suddenly really taking off with four and flying. I want to share a little example of this virtuosity. This is off your 1972 Alone at Last, first album to earn Gary Burton a Grammy. Here, big solo, The Sunset Bell. This was live at Montreux Jazz Festival. And you can hear that distinctive phrasing that Gary Burton achieved with that grip, the Burton grip, four mallets, two in each hand, The Sunset Bell. Beautiful. When you rolled that out for big jazz folks, what was their reaction? Hey, country boy with a funny grip, or you're a cool cat, Gary Burton?
Well, at first, other musicians kept advising me that, you know, that's not the way you're supposed to play the vibes.
What are you doing? Right.
Listen to Milt Jackson. That's how vibes should be played.
Yeah.
But by then, you know, and Milt was my favorite player of the established stars on the instrument at that time. But I wasn't drawn to imitate him or to play like him. By the time I discovered other players, I was pretty far along with my own, you know, style and my own approach to the instrument. So that made it possible for me to maintain my originality, which in the long run sets you apart from the other players. So it's an advantage once you get past the shock of introducing something new
right.
to people.
Absolutely. Stick with it, folks. Steve in Mandeville, Louisiana is calling. Steve, you're on the air with Gary Burton.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Gary. How y'all doing?
Good.
Hi.
I just want to thank you, Gary. I saw you at a little club here in New Orleans called Rosie's. I doubt you remember it, but it was a...
I do. It was quite a place, actually, so it's not a place you'd forget.
It was maybe 150 people tops, and I saw you twice there. I saw, you know, everything from Joe Pass to Stefan Grappelli, Flora Purim, Sarah Vaughan, you, Chick Corea, Barney and Herb, and later they turned it into a wedding kind of reception hall. And
the first time
I got to play there, I'm a musician myself, and the first time I got to play there, I stood on that stage and just went, "Oh my God!" The people that I have seen sitting here in this audience, and I'm standing here on this stage, it was pretty magic.
Steve, how long ago would it have been that you might have seen Gary Burton there at Rosie's?
Late 70s.
Yeah, that's about right.
And now you're a musician playing on the same stage. Steve, may I ask you something? Here you are, you're a musician, you're playing in New Orleans.
Yeah.
Gary Burton tells a huge musical story in this book, and it's really interesting. He also tells a very personal story about a slow coming to grips with and then coming public with his own sexuality as a gay jazz guy. And he describes how tough that was back in the early days, that the jazz culture, you know, just didn't lean toward openness around that at all or acceptance. You're a musician today in New Orleans. Is it a big deal now, Steve, if a fellow musician is straight or gay or not?
No, it's a whole lot. I mean, being gay was a horrible thing in any part of society at the time. I don't think do you think the music scene was really any different, Gary? I mean, imagine sports.
What do you say, Gary?
Yeah, well, but among in the music world, for instance, jazz was certainly uniquely narrow-minded. Classical music, for instance, it was much more accepted to be gay. And at a certain point, I even looked around and saw that there was a handful of rock musicians who were openly gay, Elton John and so on, and yet none in the jazz world. There had always been, you know, a kind of a masculine vibe about the jazz scene and the jazz musicians. And the thing is, you know, when you hear your fellow musicians making, jokes denigrating gay people, you get the message. Okay, this would not be welcome. And if I want to, you know, keep playing with these people and be part of this scene, it's something I, you know, better not, be, you know, get into. And so for the first half of my life, I managed to convince myself that I wasn't gay just by, you know, always suppressing any thoughts and feelings that
all the
I
way
had.
To marriage and children and the works.
Yeah, and it was finally in my early 40s that somebody asked me a very poignant question when I had my 40th birthday. They said, "What do you plan to do for the second half of your life?" Mm-hmm. And I thought about that for a while and decided, well, I wanted to fix anything that wasn't right in the first half. And that led me to confronting, you know, my feelings.
Sounds like a good idea. We'll hear more about that and much more. Steve in Mandeville, Louisiana, thank you so much for calling in. We picture you on the stage at Old Rosie's. We'll go out here with Duet Suite. This is another Grammy winner for Gary Burton. And pianist Chick Corea with Duet Suite from one of their many albums together, 1979's Duet. Great vibes man, Gary Burton, is with us. Join us, 800-423-8255. This is On Point. This is On Point, talking this hour with jazz vibraphone great Gary Burton about teaching and playing with the giants of jazz, himself included, about a unique instrument and a very full life. He writes about it in his new autobiography, Learning to Listen, the jazz journey of Gary Burton. It's a musical journey. It's a very personal journey, including the journey he just described some of in his own sexuality. You can join us this hour at 800-423-8255. Did you know the jazz world back in the day when coming out would have been hard, dangerous to a career? Has Gary Burton taught you, sent you with his vibraphone? 800-423-TALK. Behind us here, Inner Voyage. This is Gary Burton and the Berklee All-Stars, 1985. Of all his influences, Burton's 30 years teaching at Berklee College of Music, where he also studied, maybe one of the most notable. He joins us today from New York. Grammy Award-winning composer, educator, pioneer on the jazz vibraphone, fusion jazz. Margaret's calling from Neenah, Wisconsin. Margaret, you're on the air with Gary Burton. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. Hi, Tom. Hi, Gary. Gary, I can't wait to read your book.
Oh, thank you.
I'm a classically trained pianist, conservatory trained. I listened to a lot of jazz growing up. But my piano teachers really frowned on crossing over and experimenting with jazz. Now, as an adult, I can play whatever I want, and I just finished taking Gary's Bursera course.
An online course?
Yeah, yes. It was fantastic.
Thank you.
Gary would give us a lecture every week and then gave us these incredible assignments with, you know, one little thing to work on every single week.
And what kind of thing, Margaret? What did you get from it as a classical pianist who sounds pretty deep in a career?
Oh, well, you know, it's funny because listening to jazz all these years, I think I always assumed that they just had a better ear for it than I did. And I realized and learned through this course that there's a whole vocabulary, learning which modes go with which chords, and his idea of coming up with a motif or a storyline, repeating it, turning it upside down, inside out, and a way to keep the ear interested. It was incredible. And there were hundreds of us. I'd like to know how many people were online, and did you ever figure out how many countries were represented on that course?
How many countries, I couldn't tell you, but there were 39,000 students taking the course round that it was offered.
Wow.
And now every night where I'm playing, at least two or three people walk up to me and say, I took your Coursera course and I really enjoyed it, got a lot out of it and so on. That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
I mean, when I first created it and they were getting ready to put it up on the site, I was wondering how many people. I thought it might be a few hundred, a thousand people or something before they even got to a month before the course started, there were already 10,000 people signed up.
Oh, my gosh.
But it got almost to 40,000 by the time it rolled out. And so it turned out I was really pleased by the response. And just to think that I encouraged that many people with their, improvisation experience, I felt like I really accomplished something important.
Margaret, what are you going to do with that as a classical pianist? How will you integrate that into your musical life?
I've been playing with a big band the last 3 years and been one very frustrated pianist because if a band leader points at me and says, solo,
Yeah.
I'd freak out. So this gives me much more to chew on and to say, okay, what tools can I use from this summer to really say something with those hellos and not just be guessing and trying to just guess at what's going to sound good.
Empowered in Neenah, Wisconsin by Gary yes. Burton's Long Distance Online Course. That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Margaret. Thanks for calling.
Thank you both.
Hey, Gary, can we go all the way back? Fusion is one of your hallmarks, the things you're known for, sort of rock and mm-hmm. jazz together. I want to listen, and maybe you can describe to us, you know, what you did here. This was back in 67. Your album was Duster. Mm-hmm. 2 years before Miles Davis released his jazz rock Bitches Brew, and you were the Gary Burton Quartet came out with this. One of the first jazz fusion albums. I just want to walk into a song here, 1-2, 1-2-3-4, written by guitarist Larry Coryell. Okay, that guitar lick says rock and roll to us, but the fusion, I imagine you see, is deeper than that. What's fusing here?
Well, my idea with the band was to bring in non-jazz influences, mm-hmm. which to me were rock, country, and even classical.
Mm-hmm.
I came to the conclusion in my mid-20s that the jazz scene was pretty boxed in. We were playing everything in syncopated swing time feel. We were also using songs that were built on the kind of American songbook model.
Mm-hmm.
It was all, you know, even the originals that were being written were reminiscent of Broadway show tunes.
Yeah.
In terms of harmony structure. And I'd listen to the new rock that was coming along at that time, the Beatles, for instance, and I heard much different sets of harmonies and a real eclectic blend of different styles and influences. I mean, a typical Beatles record would have one song would have a string quartet, the next one would have some kind of Indian sitar on it,
yeah.
Then, you know, and so on. We never did that in jazz. We all the tunes were, you know, similar to each other. So I wanted to, you know, expand the palette of things that you could do. And I also wanted to reach my own age group. I was 24 mm-hmm. when I started the band, when I made that record that we're listening to.
1967, looking pretty hip here with your sort of a puffy sleeve shirt. You and a lot of others, but yeah. The long hair and the stash and the whole bit.
But I noticed that, you know, playing with Stan Getz and George Shearing, that the audiences were all in their 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
And I computed the math, and I said, well, you know, by the time I'm 40 and 50, those right. folks are going to be gone.
Yeah, build a market.
So I wanted to reach my own age group, at least to some extent.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that was my motivation and my, you know, my concept. And I'm happy to say it created a whole genre, but more than anything else, it also just opened up the possibilities for jazz improvisers, you know, to play a much wider range sure. and of styles.
Is all jazz, in a way, or most of it, fusion now? I mean, all kinds of things get tucked in.
Yes, you could say that, you know, you can spot influences of other kinds of music all the time in today's jazz players in the repertoire that we have. And we still enjoy going back and playing some of the standards in the more traditional way, you know, as well. But we're not limited to that now. We have a lot of options.
Let's go to Paul in Spring Hill, Tennessee. Paul, thanks for calling. You're on with Gary Burton.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good.
I'm fine.
Doing
what's
great.
Up?
I'm a hand percussionist here in Nashville, Tennessee, student musician. And I was uh-huh. wondering, how has the vibraphone changed from when you first started to today, as far as the metal, the wood, how it's all put together?
Well, technically and physically, the instrument has changed very little. The bars, which is the heart of the instrument, are still made the same way. They're 95% aluminum, 5% nickel. That's been the standard, and all the different companies buy their bars from Alcoa. So okay. That hasn't changed in the last 75 years. But the frame, the parts of the instrument that hold it up, they've made minor improvements along the way. I think the biggest change in the instrument has been the accessibility. When I finished high school, there were only two colleges in the country where you were welcome as a jazz musician. One was North Texas in Denton, Texas, and the other one was Berkeley in Boston.
You mean on the vibes? Only two places that said sure.
Well, not just even playing jazz, period.
At all? Oh, my God.
At all. That's 1960, there were two jazz programs in the nation.
Wow.
Now there are hundreds and hundreds, thousands of them. And you will find the vibraphone in the music departments at most schools now, at high schools and college music departments. It's now fairly standard to have a vibraphone and a marimba, another mallet instrument, available for the students. So people are exposed to the instrument quite a bit more than was the case when I was growing up.
So acceptance more than anything else. And it's out there. It's all over. Mm-hmm. Paul, thanks. Rob in Rochester, New York. Rob, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I'll be as brief as I can. My exposure to Gary and the vibraphones was through a Pat Metheny disc called The Union, which is one of my very, very favorite discs, to the point where I've re-gifted it several times over the years. Other people have bought a new copy for myself.
Good, good. You're the one that's buying the record.
Gary's comments about being the master teacher and how his career came around in a circle to perform again with Pat Metheny. I was very touched, very moved by that gift, and it's a privilege to give that to other people.
Oh, that's great, Rob. That's just great. Hey, Gary, I want your response, but let me put a little bit on so our listeners can hear that. As you respond to Rob, we've got that from 1989, the reunion album. This is House on the Hill. This is performed by Gary Burton with Pat Metheny, Will Lee, Peter Erskine, Mitchell Foreman, composed by Pat Metheny. Awesome. Here we go. Union, 1989, and you hear Pat Metheny's guitar right there along with you, Gary. You hooked Rob a long time ago with that. He's still giving it. What was that phase?
Well, Pat started his musical career in my band at age 19, and we played together for 4 years before he then went on to form his own band and launch his own career. And he's a fantastic musician. I mean, the minute I heard him the first time at a college jazz festival, I knew this guy had loads of talent. And we had a great collaboration. And we've managed to, over this 40 years now that we've known each other, we've managed to keep on collaborating. Every few years we do another tour of some kind or another record. And in fact, we're already planning our next big get-together is going to be in 2015.
Wow.
And we haven't decided exactly what it will be yet, but we put aside a time period to say, okay, it's time for another Gary and Pat collaboration.
That's awesome. Hey, from reading your book, Learning to Listen, I know that around the time of this album, Reunion, behind us here, it was around the time you first started to tell close friends, hey, you know what, I'm gay. You were coming out then. And
yes.
I know from the book how it changed, opened up your life in a lot of ways. I'm curious about those, but also, did coming out change your music? Did it free you somehow in terms of expression? I don't even know how to ask that, but it was a big deal.
That's the right question, and I do get asked that occasionally. Mm-hmm. And the answer is, I'm convinced, yes. I certainly felt much freer. something that you don't realize you're doing when you're closeted, as we say, is you unconsciously, you're constantly monitoring everything you say mm-hmm. and do
mm-hmm.
because you don't want to give any hint
right.
of this secret that you have. And so without realizing it, you're living a very kind of controlled state all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And people talk about how liberating it feels when you finally do come out. And for me, the big thing was that I didn't have to be concerned about what I was going to say or how I was going to say it or what people would think. And it felt very liberating. And I'm sure that influenced my playing as well. I don't think listening to earlier records would necessarily give the impression that I was constrained or limited, but I certainly felt freer when as the years went on, and I felt like I had gotten to know myself on a deeper level. And so, yes, I'm convinced that was the right move for me artistically as well as personally.
And now we're in a very different time. Gay marriage, legal in many states. Yourself married to Jonathan Chong.
Yes, I got married this summer.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Did you ever dream that when you first were wrestling with these issues decades ago that we'd be in a country in this kind of more accepting
Never.
Culture?
Absolutely not. I always said, well, someday this acceptance will happen, but not in my lifetime. And the amazing thing is that it has happened so quickly. Once the ball got rolling in this last couple of decades, acceptance has come much faster and farther than I think anyone expected. And it really makes me feel good about my fellow man. To realize that this change is happening at long last. Still has a way to go, but the good news is outweighing the bad news at this time in history.
Well, your autobiography really takes us through a saga there with that great change in openness in the heart of it. And if that made your music all the more free, we certainly welcome that. Gary Burton, it's been a privilege to have you. Such beautiful music for so many years. We thank you for that. And thank you very much for telling your story. It's really a great one. Thanks for sharing it with us today.
Thank you, and thanks for inviting me on the show today.
Wonderful to have you. Gary Burton, his memoir is Learning to Listen, The Jazz Journey of Gary Burton. Behind us right here, Legacy, from the new Gary Burton Quartet. Their 2013 album, Guided Tour. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.